from the Sky News Centre at 6. Angry health workers have confronted Spain's Prime Minister at the hospital where a nurse has caught Ebola. Mariano Rajoy was there to visit those looking after Teresa Romero, who is said to be in a serious but stable condition. He faced chance of go away and had medical gloves thrown at his car. Our reporter Robert Nisbet's there and says feelings are running high.
We have seen demonstrations just outside the hospital over the past few days with union members angry at what they say has been poor training, inadequate equipment, and they blame the government for cuts to the healthcare services.
David Cameron and Ed Miliband are trying to play down last night's by-election results, which saw UKIP win its first formal representation in Parliament. Douglas Carswell was re-elected as an MP in Clacton, where he'd previously served as a Conservative. In a second by-election, Labour also narrowly avoided defeat to UKIP. A dog which killed a six-month-old girl in Northamptonshire last week was an illegal breed. Police have confirmed the animal was an American pit bull. Malala Yousafzai, who was targeted by the Taliban, said she's honoured to jointly win the Nobel Peace Prize. The 17-year-old was shot in the head in Pakistan 2 years ago for campaigning for girls' rights to education. In football, Wales aim to make it 2 wins from 2 in Euro 2016 qualifying this evening. Having beaten Andorra in their opening game in Group B, they take on Bosnia-Herzegovina in Cardiff. Manager Chris Coleman says they'll respect but not fear their opponents.
We played them 3 years ago. I think we're improved since then. We're a tighter group, that's for sure. And we're all looking forward to it.
And Formula One's considering introducing automatic speed limits to slow cars down during dangerous situations on track. It's after the crash that left Jules Bianchi in hospital with a life-threatening head injury. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM. 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
OK, I see we can have some problems this evening with the CD players. Shouldn't blame the equipment. Is it going to work? We'll see. No, it certainly isn't. So there's no theme tune this evening. Looks like the heads probably need cleaning on that little CD player there. Anyway, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. And welcome to BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's a Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, diseases that appeared after the 1960s and target the immune system. So is Ebola natural or is it man-made? We ask that question. AIDS and Ebola are relatively new diseases, unknown before the 1980s. If they're so dangerous, why didn't they ravage mankind before that? Did they just appear naturally, out of the blue, or are they results of biogenetic research that escaped into the environment? So we ask that question after 6 o'clock. Also, one of the top Mexican drug cartel leaders was arrested last week, after allegedly ordering the massacre of 50 young left-wing student campaigners who were on their way to Mexico City as part of a national social justice campaign. That's what it takes for the government to act in Mexico. But what does it take here for our government to act against HSBC Bank, which looted millions and actually looked after the cartel's billions of pounds, even adapting their banks to take suitcases full of cash? So, according to whistleblower Edward Stern, HSBC are still merrily laundering drug money after being fined just a few days' profits, and no HSBC staff being jailed or prosecuted. So we speak to HSBC whistleblower Nicholas Wilson after 6 o'clock. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and some heavy and thundery showers in the early hours of the morning. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers over the weekend, with some being heavy and thundery on Saturday. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers. Next weekend, that's the 18th and 19th of October, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie. Hi, Charlotte. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
We've got some bad news for the Conservatives, really, in the Clacton by-election overnight, though, Charlotte, haven't we? Let's start with that, because this is the first UKIP MP Is this going to be the start of the landslide, the snowball? Because lots of people are getting disillusioned with David Cameron's leadership, particularly, and the Conservatives in general.
What's really interesting is, UKIP is in many ways a protest vote. People don't like mainstream politics. They don't like mainstream politicians. They don't like politicians who don't answer questions. Who knew? And the sort of the repository of all that anger at the moment is UKIP. I remember a time when I was standing for election when it was the Lib Dems. And everyone said, oh, we don't like you. You don't like Conservative. Don't like Labour. You're all the same. But those Lib Dems, they're really nice. Lib Dems came into a position where they actually had to make some difficult decisions. And lo and behold, that world which we all want to see, which seems so intuitive around a table when you're putting the world to rights, isn't that easy. And I think you're seeing something similar with UKIP. I mean, they gave Labour a very good run for their money in a safe Labour seat, as well as doing very well in the Clacton by-election. And I think it's a lot of people saying, look, you guys, we think you're all the same. You all need to look at what the problems of the world are and not look at your own electoral opportunities. And that's what people are feeling. It was obviously a disappointing result. It wasn't a huge surprise. But I think it reflects the anger that a lot of people are feeling about the way politics is, and they feel it's out of touch. However, it's very, very tempting just to get angry and have a rant over a pint, which is sort of in many ways what the UKIP is the national party of. But anyone who has put the world to rights over a pint or a cup of tea will know that it feels good at the time, but actually you finish and nothing has changed. And in life you learn that you can be very angry about something, but unless you actually fuel that anger into real practical ways of doing something about it, and guess what, most problems are much more complicated the closer to them you get, you're not going to change anything.
Well, that's one thing surely that UKIP have done, exactly, and they've identified the problem, and that is that when we elect our MPs, they're not part of a sovereign government, that they can't actually make decisions, that most of the big decisions to do with things like immigration are actually made in Brussels. So they've said, well, we want to break with that Brussels tradition, and we want to leave the EU. So anyway, they are doing exactly what you said they're not doing, and they're saying, well, this is a practical solution.
I mean, what's so interesting about UKIP is, you know, they're saying, well, we want to leave the EU, want to leave the EU. Unless we get a Conservative government, we won't have a referendum on whether we leave the EU or not. And they could, if you vote UKIP, you could get a Labour government. It's going to help getting a Labour government voting for UKIP. So I mean, many UKIP voters who say, well, we want to get out of the EU, we want the British people to have a say, if they really want to vote UKIP and we get a Labour government and Ed Miliband doesn't want a referendum on the EU and he's a Euro fan, I don't really want to hear, you know, I don't really want to hear about it when UKIP voters say, well, why can't we get out of Europe under a Labour government?
Hang on, we've got a Conservative government now. We've got a Conservative government now. I seem to remember promises that there would be a vote before the last election and the Conservatives got in.
That was the Lisbon Treaty, and the British people would deserve to say on the Lisbon Treaty. And what David Cameron said was, if he was in power and the Lisbon Treaty had not been ratified, we'd get a referendum. Jordan Brown ratified the Lisbon Treaty without giving us a referendum. Now, Cameron could have done a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty, but it would have been pointless because it was already ratified. What we've got is a bill going through Parliament, which I will want to be vote for, which will give us an EU referendum. The Lib Dems and the Labour Party, for some extraordinary reason, don't want to give the British public their say, which I think is very strange. But at the end of the day, if we want a referendum on Europe, you have to get a Conservative government because the other two parties have said they don't want to do it.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what do you think of the significance of the rise in UKIP getting their first MP today? Because actually they're going to be doing this, and they are doing this a lot at the expense of Labour votes, aren't they? In fact, there was another by-election where Labour actually only just about managed to hang on to their seat. Mm. UKIP nearly knocked you out.
Yeah, well, I think UKIP are becoming a part of British politics. The electoral system, as Charlotte's pointed out, means that if they vote for UKIP, it may be that a perverse result that people who want a referendum on the EU won't get one, because that's the way the electoral system works. But I don't think Britain is a two-party system anymore, even if it ever was. And I would have been in favour of... We're going to have to talk about how we're going to change the electoral regime, I think. And
We had a chance to do that with the alternative vote.
Well,
people
I know. But that's unfortunately...
That's kicked out into the long grass, like the Scottish referendum.
Well, it is, for many years. Don't forget, in Wales, Scotland, and especially in Northern Ireland, we already have different voting systems. So, in other words, it's already in the mix. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why the Scottish politics is drifting away from mainstream Westminster politics, because their elections to Holyrood are on a proportional system.
Look, you have to
give small parties more of a chance.
Martin, with the system that Labour, like the Conservatives, have to deal with the system we've got at the moment.
Well, we do,
and it's looking like UKIP are going to be taking loads of votes off of Labour, particularly in the north.
Well, I mean, I'm not very happy to see UKIP take all those votes up in Manchester. And if we were complacent about that, then we certainly shouldn't be. But I think most analysis suggests that they will damage the Conservatives more than they damage us. And that will possibly lead to a Labour government, which then won't have a referendum on it, because Ed Miliband's made it clear he won't have a referendum. But you can see tactical voting now is becoming very complex, very hard for people to understand, and the system is it needs reform. I think UKIP people would probably agree with this. I bet you many people who voted UKIP didn't vote for electoral reform, and therefore the perverse result of that may be that a UKIP surge denies David Cameron number 10.
One of the things I've noticed over the last probably 18 months or so is UKIP have got a tremendous amount of publicity. This may come from their European election success. Nowhere near as much as, say, the Respect Party, which also has an MP, one MP, George Galloway, and also the Greens. What do you think about that, Charlotte?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's an interesting point. I think they've got a very charismatic leader, Nigel Farage, and one thing that people do feel, and, you know, you can see, I'm an MP and I'm saying this, you can see why people feel it, is that the whole of Westminster is very out of touch, and there seems to be a kind of political language that politicians speak. So you can turn on the radio and you can tell the minute a politician's speaking, because they say certain sentences, and you think, oh yeah, it's some political babble, and you sort of switch off whichever party they are, because you know they're going to be saying that political babble stuff. And Farage has got a very good way of cutting through that, and he gives the impression of being connected and really believing what he says.
Well, is it because he's not in the thrall of some party leadership? Martin's Labour Party leadership, your Conservative Party leadership, which all has quite a rigid policy. And if you want to progress in the party, surely, you know, you have to be thinking about that the whole time. You mustn't step out of line.
I think it's two things. I think, firstly, he doesn't have the burden of responsibility of actually having to come up with a plan. I went to a lunch where he was asked questions by journalists, and he was doing brilliantly. And then a journalist said, Nigel, she said, have you got aspirations, or have you actually got a plan for all these things you say you want? And if you see a plan, can we see it? Because this is quite tough. Other people have tried it before and failed. So what's your plan? And it was the first time he was completely caught off guard. All his sort of leadership qualities went, and he looked like a schoolboy who didn't know the answer. And I thought that was interesting. It's very much harder when you're actually at the controls and you actually have to implement what you said you'd do. And the second thing, as Martin pointed out, he's the new kid on the block. He's refreshing. He's new. And that only lasts a certain time. Ask Nick Clegg.
Okay, David Cameron was rebuked. We could have run this story last week, but I held it back, especially for you, Charlotte.
Oh.
Actually, no, I forgot last week. But Cameron was rebuked over his debt claims in his conference speech. This is the Press Association. David Cameron has been handed a thinly veiled rebuke by the statistics watchdog for claiming that Britain has been paying down its debts. And Labour lodged a complaint about the Prime Minister, whose use of language after he used his Tory conference speech to hail progress in turning around the country's finances. Look what we're showing the world, Mr Cameron told activists in his keynote speech at last week's Conservative conference. Not just a country that's paying down its debts and going from the deepest recession since the war to the fastest growing major advanced economy in the world, blah, blah, blah. However, the chairman of the UK Statistics Authority, Sir Andrew Dilnot, pointed out that while the deficit has fallen since the coalition came to power, the debt has risen. So they're not actually paying down the debts at all. This is a bit of naughty speak from David Cameron, Charlotte, isn't it?
No, not really. I mean, I think it's a difficult one, because debt and deficit are two very different things. To what extent do you want to start going into what deficit is, which is the rate by which debts are getting bigger, and to what extent do you go into what debt is? Now,
because he's saying there very clearly, he's saying very clearly, paying down its debts.
Yes. So if you want to start paying down your debts, you're going to have to reduce the deficit, is something that we have done, and we are turning the economy around. I mean, we can sit arguing about semantics, and I'm very happy to do that, but the actual point is that affects people's jobs and affects people's lives. lives is that if you look at the rest of Europe, we are our economy is growing and we're picking ourselves up faster. And when Osborne was doing his plan A and Ed Balls was sort of doing funny motions with his hand and saying flatlining and go to plan B, Osborne stuck with it. And now people are saying actually he was right to do that because the economy is growing. Now, deficit and debt are two different things. Personally, I always wanted to distinguish between deficit and debt because, yeah, of course the debts are still getting bigger because that's what debts do until you've reduced your deficit and you're going into reducing.
Can we just explain the term deficit? Because what it really means, deficit, is how much less you're actually paying. Martin, maybe you can explain this as well. But I think, you know, debt, everyone understands that. That's a big figure that someone's banging on your door saying, pay me back this. But the deficit is the difference between what's actually being borrowed and what's being paid back.
An analogy, I'll let Martin do it, he's the economist as well. An analogy I've always found useful is if you imagine sort of a car speed, you know, accelerating, and you want to slow it down and get it back to where it's just come from, it's going to have to stop accelerating before it stops and starts to go backwards to where you want it to be and then goes backwards. That's probably a very bad way of explaining it. You've got to stop the amount by which it's accelerating.
The deficit,
Martin.
Well, the deficit, it's fairly straightforward. The deficit is the difference between what the government spends in a year and what it takes in taxes, and the deficits tend to go up in recessions because tax receipts go down and transfer payments to unemployed people, for example, go up. And in actual fact, having this is what economists call automatic stabilisers. So having a welfare state actually is not just a kind of a decision which is based on compassion, although it is. It's also quite a useful thing to have, because when the economy turns down, the deficits necessarily go up, and that actually protects the economy from a downward spiral. So in actual fact, you want to have a welfare state. It's actually essential part of a modern economy. Now, if we're talking about what we mentioned Ed Balls earlier, what Ed Balls was saying at the beginning of the coalition government was that there was growth in the economy, and the emphasis upon austerity. What George Osborne said, he was going to reduce the deficit to zero in one parliament. And what Ed Balls was saying is that's too far, too fast. If you try and reduce the deficit too fast, the problem with that is that you then push the economy into recession, or keep it in recession, and therefore you don't actually reduce the deficit. It's slightly counterintuitive, but I'm afraid macroeconomics is slightly counterintuitive. It's a bit like driving a car. If you try and jam on the brake, the possibility is if you're on an ice pan, you're going to skid, rather than you've got to drive into the skid. Now, so in other words, the Labour Party's position is the deficit can be reduced, but it's going to have to be reduced over two parliaments rather than one. Now, what's actually happened is that Osborne has gone to Plan B. And the fact that the deficit is not down where he wanted it to be is a result of the fact that's why the economy is growing, because he hasn't been so obsessed with austerity.
What do you make of that? Is there really a kind of secret plan B that's been brought in?
It's not a secret plan B, it's an obvious plan B.
No, it's not a secret plan B at all. I mean, Osborne's doing what he said he'd do. I mean, you can't predict by how much the deficit is going to reduce, because it depends on people. You know, people are not cogs in a machine.
But he's not quite said what he's going to do, actually, because the horizon for sorting this problem out to actually balancing the books keeps receding. Every year it goes into the future another year. It's a bit like one of those cartoons. It seems to keep changing. And we're now in a position where the Conservatives are now saying, well, in the next election, by the end of the next Parliament, we'll sort it out. Now, this is the sort of thing that voters don't like, isn't it, when they keep seeing the goalposts being shifted, especially on the economy. Because this is what government is mostly about, managing our tax spend and money.
The reality is that any country's economy is dependent on what's going on with its neighbours, what's good for us, what's going on in Europe, the global economy, global instability, and you know, you can never predict exactly what's going to happen in the future. And of course, you know, we'd like to have annihilated the deficit by the end of this parliament, but sometimes life doesn't work like that. And what you can do is look at what's happened, and we have brought the country out of recession into growth again, and that is a good thing. You know, I've you know, you have more people in jobs. It is slowly building. Of course, it's not a quick fix. Of course, it's difficult.
Well, some would say that a lot of that has been built on this quantitative easing. But anyway, another topic which I should have done last week, which I've saved specially for you. Again, I forgot it last week. Is illegal drugs and prostitution, which are boosting Britain's economy by £11 billion. Illegal activities have been included in estimates of household spending for the first time by the Office of National Statistics. Well, what a milestone. Drugs and prostitution is now part of the official official figures. Spending on illegal drugs and prostitution boosted the UK economy by an estimated £11 billion, the ONS is saying. They revised and revised report found household spending was higher in 2012, partly because of illegal activities, namely narcotic illegal drugs and prostitution. Data previously released in May estimated that illegal drugs and prostitution contributed £10 billion to the UK economy between 1997 and 2009. That figure was £6 billion more than the amount spent on house building within the same period. That's just a little bit concerning, Charlotte, that there's more money being spent on drugs and prostitution than building new homes, which we need so badly. And what are your thoughts, anyway, about the principle of including this illegal money being spent on drugs and prostitution as part of the economic figures?
It's a fascinating figure. I mean, it's not one I'd seen before, and it is, as you say, it's an absolutely staggering amount. But if you're going to start tackling our illegal economy, which does exist, it's very easy to sweep it under the carpet and pretend it doesn't. And then, of course, you don't begin to tackle not only that economy, but also the human cost of that economy, the human cost of prostitution and exploitation, the human cost of drugs. I actually think it's very helpful to include. At least you actually see what it is and it gets quantified. There's always an economic argument and there's always a human argument. And actually the human cost of drugs and many aspects of prostitution is enormous. It's the first time I've seen that figure. It is staggering.
And also worrying, isn't it? Well, what on earth is this government and the next government, if you're part of it, Charlotte, going to be doing about building houses? Because it's a bit of a sad state of affairs where more money's going on illegal drugs and prostitution than building new homes. And we know that just here in Bristol we've got something like 15,000 people registered homeless.
And I think successive governments have found it very, very difficult to build enough homes. And, you know, our population growth is enormous and our social habits are changing as well. And it's a massive challenge. And, of course, anyone who's in local politics knows that more homes is always preferable, but not near me, thank you very much. And so you always see inevitable problems arising when homes are built near people. I think giving local areas and local authorities more control over where homes are built and keep more revenue from those homes is a good thing, but it is a massive challenge.
But quite a lot of house builders are saying, I mean, we've had a situation, for example, here in the Bristol General Hospital was sold, and that was going to be a contingency there as a Section 106 agreement for affordable housing. Now, the developers then came back to the City Council and said, well, actually, building costs have gone up so much, costs of materials, the cost of labour and this sort of thing, that we can no longer actually build this with the affordable housing. So the costs of actually doing the building are rising too. It seems like a bit of a dilemma, but those houses need to be built. How do you think they should be?
Well, you can't magic money from nowhere.
Apart from QE, apparently. Quantitative easing.
There is a magic money tree.
Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts on this one too? I mean, you know, drugs and prostitution now.
In principle, it makes sense to include them, although I presume this is an estimate. I don't suppose they've looked at the receipts for all of this. But the point is that this is the trend across the world at the moment. And you know why? It's because it makes the economy that much bigger, which means deficits and debt in relation to the size of the economy are reduced. So things like the Maastricht criteria are being massaged. If you can put, I mean, the Italians, for example, led the way on this. And of course, that means that their debt on paper is less than it would have been otherwise. So in other words, they said, well, hang on, we've got a wheeze here, let's just include this stuff in. Now, of course, the drugs economy is enormous. I mean, in the second hour, we're going to be talking about HSBC's role in all of this. In 2009, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, which is staffed by police officers, produced the report, which basically said that what had happened in the crash is that all the drug cartel money, which had been hanging around, it is usually laundered, but it's a slow process. You can't launder things too fast, you can only launder little bits at a time. But during the crisis, all of this money was just sucked into the system in one go because the banks were having a panic, and the cartels just go to the banks and say, you need some money, don't you? Well, we've got some. And this was, you know, if they hadn't done that, the two things that kept the banking system solvent was A, government intervention, QE, etc., and B, the drug cartels. And in other words, our whole economic system is now actually basically entwined with the drug economy.
Charlotte, Is that what do you make of that? That's pretty scary, isn't it?
I think it raises,
they're very powerful, aren't they? I mean, we're going to be talking in the second hour with a whistleblower from HSBC. HSBC will find, I think it was $2 billion for helping the Mexican drug cartels with their money laundering. You know, so it seems that slowly but surely organised crime is kind of coming in there. And the governments around the world, particularly in the West, are looking at organised crime saying, well, look, maybe we can do a deal here if you can help our economy grow.
I think domestically it raises the question, and which it's very difficult for politicians to ask, but I think we should be asking it, do you start legalising
something? Yeah, it's the sort of thing Nigel Farage has been saying, this kind of thing.
Mm. And I think it's very difficult for any politician to tackle these questions, but that's one of the things I think people are angry with politicians about. We do need to start asking these questions, because what's the consequence of not?
Certainly, I mean, what sort of, I mean, you're talking about people being able to go down to Tesco's and buy some heroin?
No, Tony. I mean, what you do is you legalise and regulate, as you do with alcohol and tobacco. In Australia, they've got the lowest smoking rates in the world now. And that's because they're still big boozers, but they don't smoke. Over the years, it's just become, people just don't smoke in Australia. They just don't do it. And if they carry on the way they're going, pretty soon nobody will smoke. And if there's brought in laws that all cigarettes have to be sold in plain packages. And so when you say you can have this stuff, you don't say... I mean, for example, it was always policy in Britain before 1968 for people who were addicted to heroin, many of whom are medical personnel, to be given heroin. And that was a much more sensible policy than having them going banging old ladies over the head or robbing chemist shops. And ultimately, I think... The size of the drug economy, there are harms associated with drugs. Nobody should stamp that for a moment. There are harms associated with alcohol. But the real problem is the money. It's corrupting countries like Mexico and Colombia are becoming hell on earth because of the money, not because of the drugs, because
Absolutely.
Of all the money associated with it.
And a lot of the crime, a lot of our domestic problems are not the drugs themselves, but the drugs economy.
Charlotte, do you think there's the will within the Conservative leadership to take this one on, or is it just going to have to, we're going to have to wait for another generation in order to actually seriously consider decriminalising these things for their social benefit of that?
Well, I think first... I think this is one of the many things that has to be kind of done on a cross-party basis, so no one uses it as a stick to beat everyone else with. The questions have to be asked, and it has to become okay to ask the questions and to talk about
it. Well, the Lib Dems certainly have been, haven't
they?
And there are some people in the Labour Party too. So,
and there are those in the Conservative Party as well. But what you find is those who are prepared to talk about it in their parties are kind of... not backroom voices, but there's certainly more quiet voices. And I think we need to make it a much more mainstream, acceptable discussion to have.
Sounds to me like a bit of a taboo.
It is.
There's lots of taboos in politics.
Oh, right. Go on, tell us some more, please.
Well, how do you fund the health service for the next... So my grandchildren can have an NHS free at point of need. How do we actually do that with the demands that are there? You know, there's lots of... Read Charles Clarke's The Too Difficult Box book... for lots of things that politicians won't talk about because it's just that little bit too difficult. But I think we're getting to a stage where all those questions we've swept under the carpet are going to start exploding back at us, and we're going to have to start talking about them.
Sounds good. China's just overtaken the US as the world's largest economy. This is the Business Insider. Sorry, America, China just overtook you. It's become the world's biggest economy, according to International Monetary Fund. Chris Giles of the Financial Times flagged up the change. He also alerted us in April that it was about to happen. And basically, the method used by the IMF adjusts for purchasing power parity, which they explain in the article. But this is quite a biggie, Martin, isn't it? The Chinese have finally become a bigger economy than the US. And is it just a matter of time?
It's been happening for ages. Of course, there are billions of Chinese, so per head, they're still a poor country. But, you know, the things are changing in the global economy. The BRICS economies are becoming larger and more predominant. They're not very happy with the current system of governance through the IMF and the World Bank, so they're going to set up their own bank. These are big changes, and ultimately, of course, what may happen is the dollar stops being the world's reserve currency. But I mean, the problem with that is when you get a change in hegemony in the economy like that, I'm afraid it's usually associated with conflict.
Well, the US, the dollar, and oil has always been one of the most dominant forces in international economy. So, how is this change with China going to affect that?
Well, what ultimately will happen if the dollar is... I mean, if the Chinese and the Russians... Don't forget we've got geopolitical conflict now between China and Russia and the West. They will be looking to dethrone the dollar And they are looking to dethrone the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And so, for example, they're now trading with each other in their own currencies and so on. And so we're beginning to see the emergence of two big blocks. And as I say, the danger with that is that you then end up with the tensions between those two blocks lead to war. And that's the real problem with it.
Charlotte, should we be having more deals with China? They seem to be on the up, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not sort of, it has been happening. There have been major changes going on. And China's been very, very quick to get in and exploit and use world resources. I mean, they're streaks ahead of us in Africa. We all talk about investing in Africa as an emerging market, but the Chinese got there first and have been, you know, been building infrastructure and winning hearts and minds, as the phrase goes, as well as helping themselves to the country's mineral reserves.
Well, this is one of the reasons I think maybe the Americans have been sending quite a lot of troops to various different conflicts in West Africa to counter the Chinese, maybe.
But also, I mean, if you look at what Tony says and look at the setting in which that takes place, we've got two very intangible threats that we're not very well equipped to handle. We've got an ideological threat in ISIS destabilizing the Middle East and radical Islam, and you've now got Ebola. To both these things are things that it's not very easy to handle with the traditional methods of troops and throwing money at the problem. So I think we're sitting in what you could say at best a very, very interesting economic and security times.
Poor old Africa, because it looks as if the Chinese and the Americans are starting to squabble over it.
Well, yes, I mean, the Chinese National Oil Company tends to sign very long-term deals. And because they're a state-owned company, they don't have to show profits in the short run. And of course, the Western oil multinationals then complain. They say the Chinese are paying below the market rate. They're undermining us. But of course, the Chinese oil company are provided, that is the market price. Western multinationals with their short time horizons can't compete with the Chinese. And of course the Chinese are winning hearts and minds because they do offer a good price. They're good to do business with. Although what happened in Libya, of course, they had 30,000 oil workers in Libya, and as a result of the chaos that's happened there, they've had to take them all home and they've lost all their investment in that. And of course these kind of tensions are becoming very palpable. And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to go into a rant about Syria at the minute, but you can see that the flashpoints on between the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and greater NATO are potentially going to be extremely dangerous.
Well, we've had some interesting news from Germany, I suppose, we should be looking at, because they've been saying for years that it's part of the Maastricht Treaty. You're not allowed to do quantitative easing at the European Central Bank, but now they are. Barclays saying European Central Bank will be doing QE before the end of the year. Maybe you can start on this, Martin. Is this, how significant is this?
It's pretty significant. I always thought that they would do QE in the end, because they've got to. There's a potentially deflationary liquidity trap in the European Union. I mean, George Osborne yesterday was saying, if the Eurozone goes into recession, that's going to have a big impact on us, and it obviously is. Whether we're in or out of Europe, let's say that the UKIP got their wish and we were out of Europe, but the success of the Eurozone is still absolutely crucial to us either way. and the problem is that I think the Germans have been very resistant to doing QE, but they're now staring down a barrel of a gun themselves.
Well, they've been saying
the German
Martin,
economy is turning.
Martin, they've
turning.
Been saying it's illegal. It's actually part of the Maastricht Treaty.
Yeah, well, no. What they did, the German Supreme Court decided after a lot of arm twisting that they would allow it to happen, and I think that they will allow it to happen because it's happening in Japan's printing money, the US is printing money, we've printed a lot of money, so they're the odd ones out. But of course, what the real problem is for proper free market economists from the von Mises Institute will tell you, that ultimately all you're doing is blowing a massive bubble which will burst.
And the problem is that this QE money doesn't seem to find its way into the real world. It goes into share prices and this kind of thing.
Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? It's a way of propping up the financial markets. You're not supposed to do this. According to the free market textbook, you're not supposed to intervene.
When
in
a bank has got some dodgy assets or whatever, that the QE is used to buy them in order to sort of try and make out that they are worth more than they are.
The purpose of this is to keep the show on the road, and at the end of the day, keeping the show on the road, I mean, the German squeamishness about keeping the show on the road, their economy is just going into recession. And I notice also the construction in Britain fell off a cliff in August, so it may be that we've reached the turning point as well. And I'm afraid that the real danger with all of this stuff that's been going on for years is that it's basically the stock markets now are at a higher level than they were in 2008. The real economy is still in the doldrums, really, in most of the world, and the potential for a mega crash is definitely there. You, by quantitative easing, you may put it off. I think if the European Central Bank agrees to quantitative ease, the markets will like that. They will like that, and it may give some respite to world stock markets. But I'm afraid, unfortunately, I agree with the free market economists that they've got this one right. Ultimately, if you keep chucking money at the banks, eventually they go bust, and then you're really in trouble.
Yeah, this business of quantitative easing, it's not quite the same. Printing money back in the old days, apparently, was actually the government printing money and spending it into the economy, which we're not really getting. Everything seems to be going into the casino economy that we were told the government was going to separate these casino banks from the retail high street banks, and that they're so that one could not infect the other. Now, that hasn't happened, and they keep kicking that can down the road. So, anyway, what's your thoughts about the Germans finally deciding, the European Central Bank finally deciding, we're going to have to go the same way as the US and Britain have gone?
Well, not surprising, but a very worrying sign. And of course, no one likes to pump up the bubble and make it bigger, but people like less to be the one who burst the bubble and we all come crashing back down to ground. And sort of the morality of that when you're faced with the pin that you can burst the bubble with is difficult, and no one quite has the stomach to do it, and you can see why. I think we're headed in some very difficult directions. Something else that Germany has done not relatively recently is said no to nuclear power, and I know we're going to be talking about that later, which makes them more dependent on Russian gas, and Russia's hardly a stabilising influence at the moment. Because we haven't been long-term about our energy security, we're still dependent on the black stuff in the Middle East, which again, it's hardly, it's hardly Tunbridge Wells in terms of stability and nothing happening.
But what about the black stuff in South Wales? The coal?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think we're going to need, I think for a very long time, we've been living in a certain luxury of no conflict, and we haven't been taking the difficult long-term decisions, and I think they're all coming home to roost.
Well, what about this news Martin was referring to there, British manufacturing slowing further in December, illustrating fragility of the UK economy and subduing rate rise calls. This is Money, which is part of the Daily Mail. British manufacturing grew at the slowest rate in 17 months in September as demand weakened at home and in Europe, a slowdown likely to be noticed next week by the Bank of England when it again debates when to start raising interest rates. The UK Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index fell to 51.6 for September, its lowest level since April last year. So what we're seeing really, Charlotte, is the manufacturers basically saying, look, you know, we actually think even though we're hearing the economy being talked up by the Conservatives, by the Lib Dems and from Westminster, it doesn't seem to be happening.
Well, I think this plays to exactly what Tony said earlier, and I couldn't agree more, is if you actually look at it, it's down to strength of sterling and weak demand in Europe. We are we are extremely dependent, and this proves the point of markets in Europe. And I remember when I was 3 years old playing hide and seek and putting my hands over my eyes and thinking, because they couldn't see me, I couldn't see them, they couldn't see me. And sometimes the UKIP argument feels a bit like that. As long as we're out of Europe, Europe doesn't exist. But guess what? It does. And its effect on our economy is there, whether we're in Europe or whether we're out of it. And this is one indication of just how important the European economy is to Britain, in or out of Europe.
Martin, this does seem to indicate, doesn't it, that the growth is somehow happening in share prices or out of the real world. And in the real world, manufacturers are saying, look, guys, things are looking bad.
Well,
actually,
I mean, nobody talks about the balance of payments anymore, but Britain's balance of payments is very seriously in the red and has been for a long time. I think the real problem is that what we really need is a reflationary policy within the Eurozone, which Angela Merkel and the Germans have been unwilling to contemplate. But I think that they've been rather complacent about that. They've watched Southern Europe crashing and burning, and they've just wagged their fingers and given them lectures. And of course, in actual fact, what they've realised is all these Greeks are in fact their customers, and if they don't, and if Greece goes down, they go down with it. But I think the Germans are now facing a fairly serious situation. They're losing export markets. The conflict with Russia is affecting them quite severely, and. We say Britain was outside of Europe, then we would still have a vested interest in them having a successful reflationary policy. But I'm afraid the austerity policies pursued both in Europe and in Britain are not necessarily going to get us out of this crisis. The idea that all we've got to do is save the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves, the geopolitics of this, the build-up of debt, the derivatives market now is bigger than it was in 2008. Much bigger.
Well, for example, the Icelandic government, what they did is they added amounts, quite large amounts, to everybody's social security money.
Oh, yes.
Well,
helped them get out of their recession. Iceland have behaved very, very intelligently in what they've done. They basically let the banks go bust and they rescued the depositors. But of course, that meant, in actual fact, they passed the debt to the British and the Dutch governments, and the British and the Dutch governments has got so much debt that they could add Iceland's debt with hardly without noticing. But Iceland, being a small company with the country, were able to get away with that. And of course, what will ultimately happen is countries like Greece or even Argentina or whatever, they just won't pay their debts. That's what happens. In the 1930s, every single country in Latin America just defaulted on its debt. There's no law that says that you've got to pay your debts. In actual fact, you can just say, I'm not paying. And that's what eventually happens. But that is a crash when people do that. That's what causes crashes.
Okay, Brussels backs Hinckley C as cost forecasts soar. This is from the FT. Britain won EU approval for a new nuclear power plant in Somerset on Wednesday, something that Martin said he didn't think would happen, but it has, allowing the government to commit to 35 years of financial support for Europe's biggest and most controversial infrastructure project. Hinckley C will cost £24.5 billion to build, a much higher figure than the £16 billion which was disclosed last year. Crikey, that's, another quarter on top, isn't it? Another, actually, nearly a half, again, on top. 50% rise in how much it's going to cost. There you go, folks, from £16 billion till this week, it's going to be £24.5 billion. What are your thoughts about the wisdom of this? Because, of course, it's backed by Chinese money, isn't it?
It is, but I think if you look at where we are, the way we haven't tackled our energy security problem, and bear in mind, if you haven't got energy security in an unstable world, you can't do anything. All our debates about NHS, about anything else, become redundant if the lights go out. I am pleased this is going ahead. I mean, like most things, yes, it's a huge amount of money, but I think the costs of not doing it are fairly drastic.
What about the obvious thing, which most people, I mean, particularly mums for some reason, talk to me about this, is the waste. It's the nuclear waste that's produced by these plants it stays radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years, and there's nothing that the government's got, nowhere the government's got to put it properly. How would you deal with that nuclear waste?
I mean, waste management is a huge issue, but
it's extremely expensive too.
It is expensive, but again, there's often no easy answers in politics, and our waste management systems of that have to be mitigated against other wastes that we're producing that aren't radioactive, a completely different kind of threat, but are also very threatening to, you know, to the way we live, our planet in the long-term future, and it has to be balanced against that. And again, if you want to safeguard your country for the next sort of 50 years, you do have to make difficult decisions like that. Is nuclear and the waste it produces the ideal solution we'd all want? No, of course not. But until we come up with a solution that can generate that quantity of power, and that it means we're not beholden to countries that are not friendly to us, it's a very difficult option to say no to.
Apparently it's going to supply 7% of Britain's energy, Martin, this power station.
Well, yes. I mean, I thought that that Brussels would rule it out of order because it's basically state aid to industry, and the Austrians are going to appeal. Actually, I think they're going to appeal against this decision. A German minister said, "Well, this is pretty Soviet, isn't it? You're guaranteeing these people massive amounts of money for a long period." In other words, when it comes to nuclear power, all the free market textbook goes out of the window. So we can spend government money on something that wouldn't actually, under market conditions, be viable. And the reason this isn't viable under market conditions is the waste, as you pointed out, Tony. I actually wrote a paper about nuclear power in the 1990s because the Thatcher government wanted to privatise British nuclear fuels, and at first the city was really keen on the idea. Fantastic, let's privatise it. Then they had a look at the books and realised they were going to be responsible for the waste, the insurance, and that's why it's the French state and the Chinese state who are going to be our partners in this, because basically nuclear power is unviable in a free market economy.
But Charlotte, look, the main thing problem with this is it's not fair, is it? Someone's going to these guys who EDF to build this power station, and they're saying, we're going to give you a massive subsidy, super extra government money, to build this place. Apparently, it's also going to cost, according to The Guardian today, £5 billion extra adding to our energy bills. Now, for many people, they can't even afford to pay the present energy bills, let alone the extra amount of money that's going to be having to go to help subsidise this nuclear power station.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the fact it's a French company, actually a French, you know, national company, and China that are our partners in this. I'd much prefer it was either, you know, we had the capacity and the ability to invest in this ourselves, or, you know, perhaps, you know, slightly friendlier partners perhaps than China. But that's where we are.
But people cannot afford an extra £5 billion a year. This is annually, £5 billion annually
but
added
again,
to our bills.
You have to look at the alternatives. And we do have a massive energy crisis in our country. And people are struggling with energy bills. But if we are not able to provide power to our country because the global situation's changed, that's a completely different situation altogether.
On to another story, and Russia Today, the Russian English language news network, have been told they're not allowed to display. In fact, some of them have actually been taken down. Adverts in London picturing Tony Blair, Colin Powell and George W. Bush. The one with Tony Blair says, "This is what happens when there's no second opinion." And this is what happens when there's no second opinion. Colin Powell saying no weapons of mass destruction equals 141,802 civilian deaths, and false statements about the Iraq war. So the criticism is that Blair and Colin Powell and George Bush led the West into an illegal war. These are really some statements being put up, but Charlotte, they're now saying no, these Russia Today adverts have to be taken down.
I hadn't seen this story. I'm never massively keen on adverts being taken down, and as it happens, I was very, very against the Iraq war. It's why one of the major reasons I went into politics. I'm just catching up with the story now as we
speak. What do you think of these three figures? Okay, you know, I'm not expecting you to read through these adverts and everything. We've got three figures here: Tony Blair, Colin Powell, George W. Bush. Do you think any of them should be accused of war crimes? Go in the dock at the International Criminal Court? A lot of people around the world think they should. The Malaysian government, for example, has actually indicted Blair.
I find it absolutely sickening and incredible that Blair should be a Middle East peace envoy. I mean, I really, really do. It's a bit like putting Rolf Harris in charge of a children's home. It really is appalling. And I think it's one of the very, very dark chapters of the West, that the political class and, you know, conservatives voted to go to war in Iraq as well. I was desperately against it. Were all taken in by what seems a sort of a very, very dangerous union between the leaders of America and Britain.
I mean, it does seem that the International Criminal Court is a sort of imperialistic entity. When we've had, for example, just this week, the Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, has returned back to Kenya in triumph, apparently, after his appearance at the International Criminal Court. Now, he's having to go and appear in front of the International Criminal Court, but none of these three.
Well, I have to say, it does make me angry. And where's the Chilcot report? There are so many things that are silenced around this, and you do see this sort of culture of bullying and untouchability around, particularly around Tony Blair and George Bush and that whole episode, which makes me very, very uncomfortable indeed. I would like to see proper transparency on this, which I don't think we're going to see.
Martin?
Well, I mean, I think they shouldn't really be banned. Their adverts shouldn't be banned. It's a clear that Russia Today is causing the Western powers that be a bit of a problem, because it is providing an English language alternative interpretation of world events, as you and I both know, Tony, because we sometimes work with them. I think the Iraq War Chilcot inquiry, totally agree with that. I think it's quite interesting that not Carswell, the other chap, Mark Reckless, voted against war in Iraq this time, and there were some six Tories, I think, and he was one of them. I'm afraid that we're still getting a lot of propaganda you know, the mess that we made in Iraq is still a mess and is carrying on being a mess. And I'm afraid that, you know, we're still buying what is incredibly kind of one-sided propaganda about what's going on, and also utterly simplistic so-called solutions.
Well, Charlotte, we're on to Iraq War 3 now, I think, isn't it? We had the first Gulf War, we had the 2003 invasion, and now the vote the other day. What, I mean, how did you vote the other day, and also with the Syria vote last year?
I did vote with you know, the heavy heart was the phrase that everyone was talking about, with a very heavy heart. I voted for airstrikes, and that was from someone who was so fervently against going to Iraq in 2003 that I got propelled from media into politics. I think it was different. One of the things I'm very concerned about as well is that the mistake we made in 2003 doesn't only have practical, disastrous consequences on the ground, it also makes politicians very, very jumpy about repeating it. So it colours what we're going to do in the future.
But I mean, most people seem to be saying that this whole idea about airstrikes on Iraq is a ruse, really. Actually, what this is really all about is Syria. And a lot of the British military are saying we need to be in Syria. Turkey, the Turkish government are now being encouraged to go. That's NATO going into Syria without actually going and talking to the United Nations, which they're actually supposed to go to the UN Security Council and get a resolution if they want to do it. They seem to be trying to do it by the back door.
I think the whole thing has been handled disastrously by the whole of the West right from the very beginning, right from the Iraq War onwards. I was in Syria 2 weeks before civil war broke out. Now, that was in 2011. And I'm not a Middle East expert, and I was quite a new backbench MP. And it was fairly apparent from my view, being a newcomer to all this, that things were going to go very nasty very quickly, and that there was going to be no solid opposition to Assad, and that it'd be very easily hijacked by extremists and all the people we don't want to hijack it. Now, that was my view. I do ask, what on earth was the Foreign Office doing in all that? Why on earth weren't we able to help in very soft ways an opposition form against Assad so they weren't so vulnerable to being hijacked? I mean, if you go right back, this is because, you know, the Brits after various Brits and French after the war drew some straight lines down the Middle East and thought that was going to sort everything out. I think you go back a long way. The West's historic intervention and engagement with the Middle East has really bred the problems we're seeing now.
Martin, Iraq War 3. Are you against it?
I'm against it, obviously. I would have voted with the Labour left and Plaid Cymru and the SNP, exactly, who all voted against. So, I mean, that, there's a space on the left of politics developing. And UKIP. UKIP were against
it.
And
I respect that. It was a difficult...
I think it's interesting that UKIP... Nigel Farage says some very useful things about Syria and Ukraine outside the mainstream and in line with my views. I put this to you, Charlotte. Roland Dumas, who was the former French foreign minister, he's been on French television, and he's been quite clear. He said, before all this kicked off, before the Arab Spring, when I was a French foreign minister, I was approached at an international meeting by British officials, and he stressed that they were British, not US, and they said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? Now, in actual fact, MI6 and the CIA have armed, trained, and directed with their Saudi and Turkish allies and the Qatari allies, this monster called ISIS. And in actual fact, there are people in MI6 who know everything about what happened with Mozambique the other day. Mozambique had been out to Syria working with the jihadis. He comes back, he's arrested by the police. The police accuse him of jihadism. And what is his defence? I'm working with MI6. Now, what the police should have done, they then released him, and he walked. Now, the police shouldn't have released Mozambique. They should have arrested his MI6 handlers, because I'm afraid that there's an awful lot of terrorism actually embedded in the structure in the West. And everybody in the rest of the world knows it. The Russian general staff know it. The Chinese know it. Everybody knows it.
Do you think, Charlotte, that certainly that more could be done with countries like Saudi Arabia, who are supposed to be our allies, who a lot of their Wahhabi ideology seems to have been picked up by ISIS? And, you know, and actually some of these people have been recruited from there. Some of them have even, I mean, the leader, al-Baghdadi, apparently was in Guantanamo Bay, or was...
He was in prison in Iraq.
Baghdadi was meeting with John McCain just about 18 months ago. Mm. So all these people seem to be quite close to the US and quite close to the intelligence services, and surely a little bit of pressure on Saudi Arabia is what's needed.
Well, and you think as well, Saudi Arabia would be quite threatened by ISIS as well. I mean, they've got an awful lot to lose if ISIS gain power and threaten them. Yes, and I think it's absolutely vital that following from the disaster in 2003, a lot of the opposition and to ISIS and the sorting of it out comes from Arab states themselves, because what we don't want to do is inflame a kind of anti-West, further anti-West radicalism about us going in and being a clash of cultures. So a lot of this has got to come from the Arab world.
OK, down to a local story from the big global stuff. Mixed reaction from Bristol Rovers fans as the club is to sue Sainsbury's. Now, this is in August this year in the Post, Ian Onion's writing. The proposed new Sainsbury's store, which is due to be built on the current site of the Memorial Stadium in Horfield, is what we're talking about. But it seems there's been a bit of a fallout between Bristol Rovers and Sainsbury's. Do you think that the shop is actually ever going to, the store is going to be built? Will Sainsbury's actually buy this land after all this fuss?
Do you know what? I want the Memland to be sold so we can get a stadium. That's the major concern for people in Bristol, that we can actually get a stadium, a music venue, sports venue, and also it unlocks affordable housing.
We've got a stadium. It's called the Memorial Stadium. It's there for the First World War.
Yeah, you can't. I mean,
the sportsmen of the First World War. It was built for. It's the biggest. It's the biggest memorial in the city to the First World War, and we're selling it off.
The memorial area is the memorial gates, and one of the key things about the plans were to make a proper memorial garden so that you can have proper cenotaph, a proper sort of cenotaph arrangement there, and on Remembrance Day to have a proper memory of those names on those gates in a proper way. And the stadium that it unlocks, as it were, is something which would give Bristol a major conference venue, which Cardiff has and we don't have. Other, you know, Bournemouth has a major conference venue and we don't.
But Bristol Rovers is in a terrible financial mess. Aren't they just selling this land off just to try and make a bit of money? They're basically asset stripping. The other thing is that the team is now in the conference. It's a disaster. You know, I don't like to say that about a local team. I like to support it, but as a team, it's not working. Bristol Rovers isn't working, and it seems to me this is just asset stripping.
But the point, I mean, the plans to move to a much more suitable stadium have been talked about for years, and whatever any suggestion that was suggested, that people got up in arms about. We came up with a suggestion that was passed through planning process, is all ready to go. A group come up, launched a judicial review on some very, very technical small points which were dismissed. It puts everything back, and because of that delay, it looks like there's issues with sealing the deal, and a lot of money has been spent.
There are, quite clearly, if there's a legal fallout between Sainsbury's and Bristol Rovers, that's what happens when it looks like maybe the deal has gone west and it isn't going to happen.
Well, you know, it's going to be, as the situation stands, it's going to be down to a battle of the lawyers to hack out these issues that are outstanding, and I don't know the details of the legal discussions.
Well, we'll certainly have to go to those court cases and earwig and see what's going on, because last story, I think, tonight is Storm, as the NHS gives the go-ahead to patient database. Despite concerns, pilot scheme will involve 1.7 million people unless an individual specifically opts out. This is in the Mail. Sophie Borland, health officials are to go ahead with a controversial plan to harvest personal medical data of millions of NHS patients. Despite widespread concerns, a pilot scheme involving 265 GP surgeries and 1.7 million patients will see confidential medical information put on a giant computer database. Charlotte.
Yeah, I've been sitting on the Health Select Committee as this has been discussed, and there have been really major concerns. I mean, the whole thing was kind of pushed out there way before it should have been. Firstly, the concept and why data matters hadn't been explained. I mean, actually, analysing properly anonymised patient data actually helps us find cures for things like cancer and other you know, illnesses that we're trying to find. So there's a massive, massive academic benefit to being able to analyse data. But the problem has been is that we haven't been satisfied that the data was anonymised, that you could actually trace who the data belonged to, and that it was getting into the hands of organisations, insurance companies that it should have done. It's all very complicated, but personally, I think NHS England have come a long way from when they first planned to launch this thing, which was just an absolute shambles.
But they haven't lost this principle, which is the thing that really annoys me, which is you have to actively opt out. You know, otherwise that data is going to, of your private information with your doctor, is going to be harvested by these people. I mean, surely the obvious thing to do is do it the other way around. You can ask the patient's permission, and if they want to, I mean, this is a breach, yeah, surely, of the confidentiality between a doctor and a patient.
There's a lot of discussion about that, and it's a difficult one, because yes, on the surface of it you would think that, but actually if you do that, you find you're at a stage where you don't have sufficient data to do anything at all, and our research into to helping find a cure for cancer goes down a lot. Now, if you ask people...
Sorry,
do you
Charlotte,
mind...
going to have to stop you there. Okay. Time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie. After the Murdoch News, Ebola.
Mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.